Yeah, John, let's start with a broad question. I mean, I hear people saying, politicians saying the world is out of order. The world is out of joints. There are wars in Ukraine, now in the Middle East again. We are seeing the nuclear threats from North Korea. We are seeing the tensions in the South Chinese Sea. It's quite frightening. So people wonder, and I'm trying to find out who can explain me what's going on in the world and what's the realist theoretician's answer to it.
Well, a realist like me basically believes that power is the currency of international relations. And the argument that we make, we realists, is that states care principally about the balance of power. The balance of power matters enormously to states because in the international system, there's no higher authority that sits above states. So that if a state gets into trouble, it's living next door to another state that might invade it, there is no higher authority it can turn to for help. So that state has to take care of itself. And then the question becomes, in a world where great powers tend to fear each other, and where there's no higher authority that can rescue them, what is the best way to guarantee that you survive? And the best way to survive is to be powerful, to be more specific, to be more powerful than all your neighbors. Because the more powerful you are, the less likely it is that another state will attack you and threaten your survival. Of course, all states in the system understand this basic logic. The end result is that you get this intense security competition for power among all of the states, especially the great powers in the system. And sometimes that security competition leads to war. So it's this emphasis on having as much power as possible to maximize your chances of survival that sits at the core of international relations. And it, again, is largely driven by the fact that there is no higher authority that can rescue if you're in trouble. And you might very well get in trouble because another state has malign intentions towards your state.
That sounds like a quite Darwinistic view. Everybody is hostile to each other, and on a level of societies, we've kind of learned that there's something like civilization that fights against the Darwinistic intentions and the Darwinistic intention or Darwinistic nature of human beings. Isn't there something like that on an international level as well? A process of trying to define rules, institutions that fail, but that work hard on implementing something like a common ground, common values in the world.
Well, the fundamental difference between what happens inside a society or in domestic politics on one hand and the international system on the other hand is that inside a society, you have a higher authority that you can turn to for protection. It's called the state. You have hierarchy inside states. In the international system, you do not have hierarchy. You have no higher authority. You live in what we call, in the international relations world, anarchy. So it's anarchy, no higher authority in the international system. And inside of a state, because you have that state, it is hierarchy. To illustrate this point in a bit more detail, think of Thomas Hobbes. Hobbes talks about individuals in the state of nature. In the state of nature, there's no higher authority, and it is an atavistic world. It's a dog-eat-dog world in the state of nature. What does Hobbes recommend for getting out of that state of nature? What he recommends is creating a leviathan. A leviathan is a state. Once you move to a leviathan, you have hierarchy. Right? The problem in the international system is that there is no Leviathan. There's no world state. So in a very important way, the international system is synonymous with Hobbes's state of nature.
But there have been attempts to find rules since Europe ended the 30 Years' War in the Westphalian Peace Order. States have kind of come to terms, and in the 20th century, we have seen institutions like the League of Nations and today the United Nations coming up, not being the Leviathan of the global order, but having power implementing rules. And I watched the UN General Assembly and I saw 190 and something states referencing to international rules and to an international order, which they somehow feel they all respect or should respect.
The League of Nations and the United Nations and all other international institutions have no real teeth. If a great power like the United States or Russia or China decides that it's going to ignore the rules, there's nothing those institutions can do about it. Furthermore, those institutions are basically rules and norms, and I think your language conveyed that. The question then becomes, who writes the rules? And the fact is, the most powerful states in the system write the rules so they advantage those powerful states, right? So it's the United States that has created the rules-based order that people in Germany and other European countries love, right? It's the United States who created those rules. You like those rules. But if the United States decides that it wants to do something that requires violating the rules, the United States just violates the rules. And who's going to stop the United States? There's no higher authority. There's no Leviathan. And you talk about the United Nations.
But also the United States are paying a price when it comes to respect. And we are seeing that. They are losing respect. They are losing ground in the international world, particularly in a time when other states from the so-called global south are becoming more powerful, more influential in the world.
I think there's no question about that. The United States is paying a price, but that doesn't stop the United States from violating the rules. And if you are a state in the international system and you see the United States violating the rules and getting away with it, how much faith do you have in the rules? And the answer is not much. So if you go to Beijing or you go to Moscow and you talk about the rules-based order and say that they don't have to worry about the United States aggressing against them because the United States will adhere to the rules of international politics, they'll laugh at you. They'll think you're crazy because they don't trust the United States to obey the rules. And they also understand that if the United States disobeys the rules, the higher authority that should be there to come down and punish the United States doesn't exist.
But your opponents, like, for example, John Eikenberry, the advocates of international liberalism, they would say, of course, no, the international liberal order was never perfect, but we have to accept that there is something that nations, that states were striving for something, and why should we accept that this was that there were failures all the time? We should continue striving for what they call a liberal international order.
Well, you definitely had a liberal international order, and that was true during the unipolar moment. And the reason you had it is there was only one great power in the system, by definition.
You're talking of the time after post-89.
Yes, I'd say roughly from 1989 up till about 2017, right? That period is the unipolar moment.
But the order we are talking about, the United Nations and the League of Nations, were created before. That was the League of Nations, Harold Wilson, after World War I.
The League of Nations had no teeth. That's why you got World War II. 20 years after World War I, you had World War II. Right. And during the Cold War, the United Nations mattered for little because the Soviet Union had a veto and the United States had a veto. And any time we proposed something the Soviets didn't like, they vetoed it and vice versa. These institutions just don't matter very much. The General Assembly has no teeth. The Security Council has some teeth. but it only has teeth when both the U.S. and the Russians and the Chinese all agree.
What's the consequence? What should, from a realist's perspective, be the consequence? Would you say these institutions are completely useless? Because I just saw how, for example, the German government in the last years since the Russian invasion of Ukraine was working hard to gain support and majorities in the UN General Assembly. It completely changed politics. They were starting to address to talk in a new way to the states of the global South, because they believe that it matters if you have a majority in the General Assembly of the United Nations, even if there is no state-like authority with it.
Look, it's very important to understand that in a highly interdependent world, a highly globalized world like the one that we live in, you need rules to conduct business on a daily basis. So you have all sorts of institutions that play a very important role in facilitating economic and political intercourse among the various states in the system. And that's why these institutions are important and why they're not going away. But the key point that you want to keep in mind, and this is what drives the realist train or the realist story, so to speak, is that no state can be absolutely certain that another state won't break those rules and attack militarily that state. So if I'm Russia, right, and I'm dealing with the United States, there's no question that there are all these rules and all these institutions where we interact. The United Nations is a perfect case in point. Russia is in the United Nations. The United States is in the United Nations. Or if you want to go to China and talk about the World Trade Organization, China is in the World Trade Organization, and it has benefited greatly from its presence in that institution. And the United States, of course, was the driving force behind the creation of the WTO. So the rules in the WTO, the rules in the UN matter to these three great powers. But the reason they compete for security, the reason you have this intense military competition, the reason the realist story is so powerful is because neither Russia nor China nor the United States can be certain that one of those other great powers won't break the rules and threaten them. And once that possibility is on the table and there's no higher authority to come in and rescue those great powers, it causes those states to compete for power. And just to go to the Chinese here, the Chinese understand full well what happens when you're weak, when you don't have a lot of power in the international system. They call it the century of national humiliation. The Chinese understand that when they were weak, the great powers in the system took advantage of China. They humiliated China. And if you go to China today, they will tell you very clearly they have no intention of ever letting that happen again. That's another way of saying they have every intention of maximizing their relative power. They want to be really powerful. They want to be the dominant state in Asia. And I don't blame the Chinese at all. If I were running national security in Beijing, I would want to dominate Asia. I would want to be the most powerful state in Asia, and I would want to push the United States out of Asia as quickly as I could. Why? Because that's the best way to survive in a system where there's no higher authority to protect you.
And that's why you propose that we have to understand these actors, be it China, be it Putin's Russia, as rational actors in the global theater.
Yes.
What's the rationality behind it? How far would you go to claim that international actors, state, act rationally? I mean, of course, we mostly believe that Putin's invasion of Ukraine was irrational, or that Xi Jinping is striving to annex Taiwan, not for rational reasons, because he's dreaming of restoring an ancient Chinese empire of other centuries, which wouldn't be considered a completely rational argument.
Well, my basic argument, and as you know, Sebastian Rosato and I wrote this book on How States Think.
Yeah, that's
How
the latest
States
book.
Think. Yes, that deals with the question of whether states are rational most of the time. And our argument is that states are routinely rational. And this, of course, includes great powers. And we talk about the Putin case at the start of the book. And I think, as you say, most people in the West believe that Putin was irrational when he invaded Ukraine. And the reason is that they think that Putin was an imperialist who was bent on creating a greater Russia or even reestablishing the Soviet Union. And the argument is that this was delusional, and anybody who had those kind of goals and pursued that sort of policy in the year 2022, which of course was year.
But there were some arguments for it. I mean, he had written about this idea of a Russian, great Russian empire, and that Ukraine never existed as a state. There was this article he published half a year before he invaded, which laid out a program, an imperial program.
I don't believe that at all. In fact, I think the article says exactly the opposite. This is a myth that's pervaded in the West. There is no evidence, zero evidence, that he ever said anything or wrote anything that conveyed that he had imperial ambitions and that he was interested in conquering Ukraine and making it part of a greater Russia. This is a myth. And in fact, if you think about what happened immediately after the war started, remember the war started on February 24th, 2022. Shortly thereafter, in March and early April, negotiations opened up between Putin and Zelensky, between the Russians and the Ukrainians, mainly in Istanbul, to shut the war down, to stop the war. And there was almost a deal on the table. There was almost a deal on the table between the Russians and the Ukrainians to end the war. And of course, the United States and its European allies came in and killed the deal. We told Zelensky to walk away. But you almost had a deal. If you think about that, that is inconsistent with the argument that Putin was bent on conquering all of Ukraine. Furthermore, he went into Ukraine, the Russian army went into Ukraine, with at the very most 190,000 troops. There is absolutely no way he could have conquered all of Ukraine with 190,000 troops. When the Germans went into Poland on September 1st, 1939, and you want to remember the Germans were only going to capture the western half of Poland because the Soviet Union was going to capture the eastern half of Poland. So the Germans went into Poland September 1st, 1939 to conquer it and incorporate it into a greater Germany with 1.5 million troops. Does anyone seriously believe that Putin, with 190,000 troops at the very most, was going to be able to conquer all of Ukraine, which is much bigger than Poland and certainly much bigger than the western half of Poland?
Well, most people believed he would be successful. And there, of course, there are other perception and other narratives about what happened in the first period of the war. And there's also the perception that Ukraine is struggling for its right to exist as a state and to for the right to have its borders respected. So what would a realist's answer or reaction to the Russian invasion to the Russian attack have been, considering that you say it was a rational act, which can be understood by rational arguments?
It was announced in April 2008 that Ukraine and Georgia were going to become part of NATO. That's when the trouble started. It was the annual NATO conference, April 2008, in Bucharest.
Bucharest.
It was in Bucharest.
And Merkel and Sarkozy at the time opposed it.
Absolutely.
And were in a heavy conflict with the United States.
And Angela Merkel later said that the reason she opposed it, and she adamantly opposed it at Bucharest, was because she understood that Putin would see it as a declaration of war against Russia. Just think about what Merkel was saying. Putin would see it as a declaration of war. Well, the Russians made it manifestly clear in April 2008 that Ukraine becoming part of NATO and Georgia becoming part of NATO as well was unacceptable. Unacceptable. And Bill Burns, now the head of the CIA, who was the U.S. ambassador to Moscow at the time, made it very clear in an important memo to Condoleezza Rice, who was then the Secretary of State, that virtually every member of the Russian foreign policy elite was adamantly opposed to NATO expansion into Ukraine. The question you then have to ask yourself is, what did the United States and its allies do? They continued to push and push and push to bring Ukraine into NATO. The Russians saw this as an existential threat. They made it abundantly clear that it was an existential threat and they were not going to tolerate it. What did we do? We continued to push and push and push. And in December of 2021, when Putin put forward a diplomatic solution, which he forwarded to the head of NATO and to President Biden, how did the United States respond? The United States said, we're not going to negotiate with you on the issues that concern you. That's the end of the story. And a month later, Russia invaded Ukraine. And they invaded Ukraine because of good old-fashioned balance of power politics. This was rational. The Russians made it clear that NATO on their doorstep, Ukraine and NATO, was categorically unacceptable.
Yeah, but you're describing Ukraine as an entity, as a state that is pushed or driven by NATO and by U.S. interests. Ukrainians would claim, no, we wanted to join NATO. Georgians claim they wanted to join NATO. The Baltic states claim we wanted to join NATO. We wanted to become a part of the Western world, of the European Union. That's part of our self-determination. And that's part of an international rules-based order that protects self-determination of states.
You can make that argument, but it's a foolish argument. And the fact is that in international politics, if you're a small state and you live next door to a great power, you have to pay very careful attention not to alienate or anger that great power. Because if you do, that great power may crush you. This is the case here in the Western Hemisphere. The United States has the Monroe Doctrine. And the United States basically says the Western Hemisphere is our neighborhood. And no great power, no distant great power, is allowed to move military forces into the Western Hemisphere. It's called the Monroe Doctrine. And in 1962, when I was a young boy, the Soviets put missiles in Cuba. The United States told the Soviet Union in no uncertain terms, those missiles have to be taken out of the Western Hemisphere. They have to be taken out of Cuba. You are not allowed to put military forces, you, the Soviet Union, in the Western Hemisphere. This is our backyard. Well, the same basic logic applies to Ukraine. The Russians don't want a military alliance that was a mortal foe of the Soviet Union during the Cold War on their doorstep. Why Americans don't understand that is hard to comprehend.
What's the message? What does this message means, or what is the message behind this argument to Taiwan these days?
Taiwan's a very different story because we are already in East Asia as a result of the Cold War and World War II. In other words, we don't have to move across the Pacific Ocean up to Taiwan. The United States and Taiwan were close allies, de facto allies, for a long, long time, right? And we have powerful bilateral alliances with South Korea, with Japan, with the Philippines, with Australia. So we're there, right? We're trying to defend the status quo. What you saw happening in Europe is fundamentally different. You remember when the Cold War ended in 1989, right? We promised that there would be no NATO expansion. And then what happened moving forward is that NATO slowly but steadily moved towards the Russian border. The first tranche of expansion was in 1999. The second tranche of expansion was in 2004. And then in 2008, at the Bucharest summit, we announced that Ukraine and Georgia would become members of NATO. The Russians screamed bloody murder in 1999 with the first tranche. They screamed bloody murder in 2004 with the second tranche, but they couldn't do anything to stop it. But after 2008, they were certain they were going to stop this one. And it's no accident that in August of 2008, that's 4 months after the Bucharest summit, you had a war between Georgia and Russia, because the Russians made it clear to the Georgians through this war that you are not becoming a member of NATO. And of course, this is exactly what happened to Ukraine. And when people like you say Ukraine has a right to join NATO, and you push the Ukrainians to pursue that right, the end result is that you have pushed Ukraine to the point where it is being destroyed. It's very important to understand that. The end result of NATO expansion into Ukraine is that Ukraine is being destroyed as a state. All that's going to be left after it loses a huge chunk of its territory is a dysfunctional rump state. That's the consequence of following your argument that Ukraine has a right to join NATO.
So what is the realist alternative?
The realist alternative was to back off on NATO expansion.
No, I mean now. I mean, we are in a war, and the United States, we have an election year in the United States, so it's on the table. What shall the United States do, and what's the realist's advice?
Well, the realist advice would be to now try to cut a deal with the Russians, push the Ukrainians to cut a deal, the best possible deal they can get. And that deal, I think, would involve the Ukrainians immediately saying they have no intention of joining NATO. Their goal is to become a truly neutral state that takes into account Russian security interests. And in return, they will allow the Russians to keep most of the territory, if not all of the territory, they now control. That would be the deal. Is anybody going to accept that deal in Ukraine or in the United States or in Europe? No. So a realist like me who makes that recommendation is whistling in the wind. It's all a waste of time.
Well, we'll see what's happening in the elections in the United States. And
It doesn't matter. The Republicans and the Democrats are not much different on this issue. The fact is that we're deeply committed to Ukraine, and it's very hard for us to just abandon Ukraine at this point in time. And it's certainly difficult for the Europeans, especially the Germans, to abandon Ukraine. So we're not going to abandon Ukraine. We're going to continue to support Ukraine. They're going to continue to fight in one way or another, in all likelihood. And the end result is this is going to go on and on. And it's going to poison European relations with Russia for as far as the eye can see.
Let's look back into history. This debate between realists and international liberalists is ongoing since decades.
Centuries.
Where do you see in the U.S. politics, let's look back in the last, in the post-Second World War era, where do you see U.S. politics following a realist course, and where do you see it following an opposite liberalist course?
My argument is that for almost all of its history, the United States has behaved in a realist fashion, and it's disguised its realist behavior with liberal rhetoric. The one exception to that is the unipolar moment. And during the unipolar moment, the United States was the only great power in the international system. That's why it's called the unipolar system. Single great power. And because there was only one great power, you did not have security competition among the great powers, because there were not even two great powers in the world. That meant that the United States did not have to pay attention to realist logic during the unipolar moment, and it could act according to the dictates of liberal ideology. So I argue that during the unipolar moment, the United States pursued a policy of liberal hegemony. And my argument is it's the only time in our history where we have actually pursued in a meaningful way a liberal foreign policy. But then that all came to an end in roughly 2017 when the world changed from a unipolar system to a multipolar system, with number one, the rise of China, and number two, the fact that Putin brought the Russians back from the dead.
So after World War II, I believe your argument is United States only acted in their own interest to maintain their power in the bipolar, upcoming bipolar world and the power struggle with the Soviet Union. Of course, in Europe, there are other perceptions. I often think of my father, who's in his late 80s now, who was a boy in school when the Second World War ended, and who told the stories from a small town in Bavaria when American officers came into their school, gave them paper and a little printing press so they could print their first school magazine, and they defended the young students against the old German Nazi teachers and implemented the idea of a liberal democracy in Germany. So that remained as a memory for an entire generation in Germany, that that the post-war order in Europe, particularly in Western Europe, wasn't only in America's self-interest. It brought something. It was liberal democracy in our own interest.
Well, the fact is that we stayed in Europe after World War II because we had to contain the Soviet threat. Otherwise, we would have gone home. If you think about World War I, Imperial Germany was defeated, and it had harsh terms dictated to it at the Versailles Treaty. It could maintain an army of only 100,000 men. So the Germans, after World War I, were no threat to anyone. And the Soviet Union was a basket case. It had a civil war. It was very weak. And it had been defeated, in fact, in World War I by the Germans. It had been knocked out of the war. And you had the famous Treaty of Brest-Litovsk in March 1918, where the Soviets were humiliated by the Germans. So there was no Soviet threat after World War I for us to contain, no German threat for us to contain, so we went home. We were primed to go home after World War II until we realized, oh my God, the Soviet Union just defeated Nazi Germany. The Red Army is incredibly powerful. France and Britain are in no position to check it, and therefore we have to stay in Europe. So that's what kept us there. Now, the United States behaved in a remarkably smart and benign way towards West Germany. And this is what your father experienced. That was really, in a very important way, liberalism at play. The basic motive for us to be in Europe was Realpolitik 101, contained the Soviet Union. But in terms of how we conducted ourselves, not only politically, which is what you were focusing on, but economically as well, had a very heavy liberal tinge to it. So it's no surprise that most Europeans today view the United States as something of a benign hegemon. The Europeans do not want the Americans to go home. You saw this when the Cold War ended. Cold War ends, Soviets leave Eastern Europe. Why don't the Europeans say to the Americans, thanks for everything you've done, now it's time for you to go home. We want to regain our full sovereignty, right? We don't want the United States interfering in our politics the way the United States does when it's in Europe. No Europeans said that. In fact, the Europeans were desperate to keep us there. Why? Because they wanted the American security umbrella their head.
So you remember you recommended in, I think it was 2012 and earlier on, to think about equipping Ukraine and Germany with nuclear arms, did you?
Oh, in 1993, when there was a big debate about what to do with Ukrainian nuclear weapons, you want to remember when the Soviet Union broke up, four of the new states had nuclear weapons: Russia, Kazakhstan, Belarus, and Ukraine. Kazakhstan and Belarus got rid of their nuclear weapons without putting up much of a fuss. The Ukrainians were tempted to keep their nuclear weapons. I believe I was the only person in the West who argued that Ukraine should keep its nuclear weapons. And my argument was that someday there may be trouble and Ukraine will need those nuclear weapons, not to use them, but for deterrence purposes. Remember, nuclear weapons are the ultimate deterrent. And my basic view, by the way, was at the time, this is before NATO expansion. So NATO expansion was not the issue here. My point was that you had Russians and Ukrainians who were intermingled. And if you looked at what was happening in the Balkans at that point in time, an intermingled population of Russians and Ukrainians could lead to big trouble down the road, in which case the Russians might think about invading to deal with the so-called near abroad in Ukraine. So I said if Ukraine had nuclear weapons, that would facilitate stability. Of course, everybody thought I was crazy, especially President Clinton, and he forced the Ukrainians to give up their nuclear weapons. I would note to you that President Clinton has now said that it was a mistake on his part to coerce the Ukrainians into giving up their nuclear weapons.
When it happened now, a few days after the Russian invasion into Ukraine, the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz in the German parliament used the term Zeitenwende, the turn of the times. What do you make with that term, which became internationally quoted again and again?
Well, I think that it's very clear that everybody was shocked, truly shocked, by the fact that you had a war in Ukraine involving a great power, and that not only that, but the United States on the other side was deeply involved in Ukraine as well, not doing the fighting. So you couldn't say that this was technically a great power war where the United States and Russia were fighting against each other. But you were about as close to that as you could get. And this had all sorts of consequences for the Germans, because the Germans are joined at the hip with the United States because of the NATO connection. And so I think that Germans at that point in time were forced to sort of rethink their view of international politics, especially as it applied to their backyard. But I think if you look at what's happened with the passage of time, not that much has really changed in Germany. And I think it's in large part because the Germans, like all Europeans, depend on the United States. They take their direction from the United States, and they pass the buck to the United States. This is not to say the Germans have not given a lot of money to Ukraine, and they've given some weapons as well. But the Germans ultimately do not want a leadership position in terms of dealing with Ukraine because of history. Furthermore, it's just much easier to let the Americans do the heavy lifting.
So, but there is some feelings in some years that, well, something's generally changing. Angela Merkel, I think it was the last year in her office as chancellor, said we have to accept that we have to take more responsibility for us, that the Americans won't do it as we were used for it. We see the possibility of Trump being in the Oval Office again. So what do you see coming? What do you see? Are we necessarily entering a phase of multipolarism, or, as you just, if I understood you right, mentioned, will we continue living in a world as we somehow knew it before?
Well, there's no question we're in a multipolar world. And there's no question that it is possible that the United States' relationship with Europe, and in particular Germany, will change in the future. It's very important to understand that the most important threat that the United States faces in the world is China, and China's in East Asia. And we have a deep-seated interest in pivoting to Asia. We, despite our behavior, have a deep-seated interest in passing the buck to the Europeans, especially the Germans, to deal with the Ukraine problem so that we can pivot out of Europe and deal with China. And now, as you well know, we have a major war going on in the Middle East. And because the United States and Israel are joined at the hip, we are deeply involved in that war. So we have taken our eye off of Ukraine, and we have concentrated in recent times on the Middle East. And it doesn't look like we're going to abandon the Middle East and go back to focusing on Ukraine. So if you think about American interest in what's happening in the Middle East, which shows no signs of ending anytime soon, and you think about the fact that the most important theater of operations for us is East Asia, you can tell a story where Europe gets left behind. And we say to the Germans and to the other European states, you have to handle the Ukraine portfolio. You can see that happening. The counterargument to that is the United States is so rich and the Europeans are so used to being told what to do that the Americans will handle the Ukraine portfolio, the Middle East portfolio, and the East Asia portfolio all at the same time. That may happen.
And that depends on the outcome of the election in the United States?
I think that the outcome of the election matters. I mean, the question you have to ask yourself, and here there's no clear answer, is how much Trump will matter. It's clear when Trump came into power last time that he wanted to fundamentally alter America's role in the world. Remember, Trump is the person who abandoned engagement with China.
Yes.
And moved to containment with China. The present troubles between the United States and China really started with Trump, and then Biden followed in Trump's footsteps. So Trump mattered there in terms of, with regard to China, Trump mattered in terms of altering fundamentally U.S. foreign policy. But you also remember he wanted to pull out of NATO. He wanted to have friendly relations with Russia, but he was unable to do that, right?
But in the core, would you describe him as a realist in his foreign policy perception?
Trump?
Yeah.
Yes. I think Trump is definitely a realist. And this is not to defend his conduct of foreign policy when he was president, because Trump's ability to execute a realist foreign policy is wanting in the extreme. I mean, he's incapable of managing foreign policy in a sophisticated way. I think his handling of relations with allies was an especially bad situation. So I'm not a fan of his actions in office. But with regard to your specific question of whether he had realist instincts or basically a realist view of the world, I think that's true. He does not have a liberal view of the world. Biden is a liberal at heart, right, who is president at a time where he has to be a realist. He has to think about containing China, right? He has to think about waging war against Russia in Ukraine and so forth and so on. So he's a liberal who's been forced to act like a realist and, of course, disguises behavior with realist rhetoric. I mean, with liberal rhetoric, excuse me. But Trump was a different kettle of fish. Here's the key question with Trump. When Trump first came to office in 2017, he had no choice but to bring in advisors who represented the establishment and who went to great lengths to thwart him at every turn. People like John Bolton, General John Kelly, and so forth and so on.
And they all left after a few months.
Right. And of course, they all left because they were at loggerheads with him. Trump had different ideas than they did, and they constantly clashed. This is clear. The argument now that Trump people make is that they're putting together a team for 2025 that's comprised of individuals who don't represent the establishment, but who share Trump's worldview.
Yeah. Richard Grenell, for example, who we know as the U.S. ambassador in Germany at the time. And
yes. Yes. So that's a story that says that if Trump is elected and moves into the White House in 2025, right, you will get a radical change in American foreign policy because he, Trump, has a team behind him that shares his worldview, which was not the case in 2017.
But what does it mean from your perspective, describing him as a prototypical realist politician? And I remember Trump portraying his worldview in the United Nations when he gave an address there. That was perfectly the world of international anarchy and nation states striving for their, everyone on its own, striving for their own benefit. So what happens when he comes in with this new team, which, I don't know, might be more professional, more eager, more striving?
Let's just talk about the different theaters. Let's talk about East Asia first, then talk about the Middle East, and then talk about Ukraine and Europe, okay? I think with regard to East Asia, little will change because he was the one who initiated a containment policy against China. Biden followed in Trump's footsteps, and one would expect little to change in East Asia, with one caveat. I don't think Trump will treat our allies in East Asia as well as Biden has treated them. Trump has a tendency, as Germans know, to treat allies in bad ways. And he treats them as if they're hostile adversaries, which is foolish. So I think we will continue to pursue containment in East Asia, and Trump will not do as sophisticated a job as Biden has done working with allies. With regard to the Middle East, there's no president of the United States who's not going to back Israel to the hilt. So I think there will be little difference between how Trump behaves towards Israel and the Middle East more generally and how Biden has behaved. You want to remember that when Trump was president, I think it was in 2018, he pulled out of the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement with Iran. This was a foolish move. And Biden, when he ran for president, said that if he was elected, he would go back into the JCPOA. He has not gone back into the JCPOA. And if you look at Biden's policies in the Middle East towards Iran, towards Israel, they're indistinguishable from Trump's. So I think there won't be any change there. The interesting question is what happens in Ukraine, right? And there, not only Trump, but lots of Republicans look like they want to abandon Ukraine. And it's very clear that the Biden administration does not want to abandon Ukraine. So you can tell a story that the one major change that will take place when or if Trump gets elected and comes into the White House in 2025 is American policy towards Ukraine. And if we were to sort of pull the plug and basically abandon Ukraine.
What do you recommend? What your recommendation is?
Not
more
now,
or less.
Not now. No, my recommendation now is to try to work out a peace agreement. I'm not talking about abandoning Ukraine. It makes me sick to my stomach to think about abandoning Ukraine at this point after the sacrifice they have paid and after how hard we have pushed them to fight this war. No, I'd much prefer to work out a negotiated settlement and have the United States stay there and do everything it can to get as good a deal as possible for the Ukrainians, right? And this is going to sound funny coming from a realist, but there's an important moral dimension to my argument here. But anyway, as I said to you before, I don't think anybody's going to listen to me, and I think we're going to continue the fight. But the qualification there is maybe we won't continue the fight if Trump is elected. And if that happens and Trump pulls out of the Ukraine conflict, the question then is, what are the Germans going to do? What are the Europeans going to do? Because you have a deep-seated interest in checking Russian power and making sure that Ukraine is not totally destroyed. And if the Americans are not there to help in any meaningful way, the Europeans, and I think this means the Germans, are going to have to step up and do something. Do I think that's a likely scenario? No. I think it could happen. But I think the structural forces inside the United States are such that it would be very hard for Trump to just simply abandon Ukraine.
So last question. I was surprised to read that in the last election, you supported Bernie Sanders. Is that right?
Correct. So I supported him in the last two elections. I voted for him in 2016 and in 2020. And in both cases, this was in the Illinois primary. As you know, I live in Chicago, which is in Illinois. And in 2016, it was Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary in Illinois, and I voted for Sanders. And for in 2020, reasons? It was Biden versus Sanders, and I voted for Sanders.
For what reasons?
Well, I think it has to do with American domestic politics more than international politics. I think the United States is in deep trouble at home. I think in particular the huge economic inequality that we have and all the problems that we have in terms of the opioid crisis and race relations and so forth and so on mandated a fundamental change in how we did business inside the United States. I mean, I want to be clear. One of the reasons I was in favor of pulling out of Europe and putting an end to NATO early on was I agreed with Barack Obama's famous saying that what we needed to do was nation building at home, right? And I think that presidents, you know, since the Cold War has ended, when presidents had a chance, you know, to reduce our commitments abroad and focus more on fixing problems at home, we went in exactly the opposite direction. Right? More emphasis on globalization, which meant loss of jobs at home, which people didn't try and compensate for. Very little spending on infrastructure inside the United States and so forth and so on. Not paying attention to all of the economic inequality and what the consequences of that are. So I was in favor of not trying to run the world and do nation building in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Libya. I was interested in doing nation building at home. And I thought Bernie Sanders was the best hope in that regard. And by the way, I would note to you as evidence of how much trouble the United States is in, that in 2016, the leading Republican candidate was Donald Trump. I never imagined in my wildest dreams before 2016 that Donald Trump would be a serious candidate for president. And the person who would have won the Democratic nomination in 2016 had the Democratic National Committee not moved in and squelched him in favor of Hillary Clinton was Bernie Sanders. You could have had a Bernie Sanders versus Donald Trump election campaign or election fight in 2016. The idea that Bernie Sanders was a serious candidate in 2016 and that I would vote for Bernie Sanders in 2016 would have been unthinkable up until about 2016. But this just shows you the rise of Trump and the rise of Sanders, how much dissatisfaction there is inside the United States. And to sum it up, that's why I voted for Bernie Sanders.
So there's no Bernie Sanders this time. What do you hope for?
I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that. I don't find Joe Biden an attractive candidate at all. I certainly dislike his policies on Ukraine and on Gaza intensely. I think he's too old for the job. I think his critical faculties are slipping in a serious way. And I think that over the course of 4 years, he's not going to be up for the job. And I would not vote for Trump So I'm kind of at sea here.
John, thank you.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for making your room a radio studio.
It's a great...